Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for people who feel disconnected from church. On today's Off Grid Christianity podcast, John J. Thompson joins me to discuss his life to date, which includes his book, Jesus, Bread and Chocolate, plus being a pastor and a major player, those are my words, within the contemporary Christian music scene. He also is a very popular person with his own podcast called True Tunes, and I thoroughly recommend you checking that out. By the way, our email address, should you want to get hold of me, is OGC, funny enough, stands for Off Grid Christianity. That's OGC at accessradio.biz, and biz is spelled B-I-Z. John, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And I can hear people saying, first of all, what does the J stand for in John J. Thompson?
Joseph. It's just my middle name. John Thompson is such a common name that I got mistaken for too many other John Thompsons. So a long time ago, I started to go by either John J. Thompson or JJT, just to keep
as
me
you
from
do
getting checked into the wrong hotel rooms. You know, kind of thing. It's purely functional, but it's become sort of a thing. So
no, I get that. And we used to have an actor over here, very, very famous comedian. I don't think he ever made it over to the States, but it was a show called Steptoe and Son. In fact, Steptoe and Son was transferred into an American big sitcom in the 70s. It was a family name. Can't remember. Anyway, his name was Harry H. Corbett. And there was already a Harry Corbett, so he decided to call himself Harry H. I think H just for heck, you know, what's
going to be. Yeah, I should have made it X or something. That would have John X. Thompson would have probably sounded cooler, but I wasn't thinking.
No, it's pretty good. Right, well, for those that are regular listeners, know we have five really, really deep penetrating questions to ask you. So we can get a bit of an understanding of what makes you tick, who you are.
Sure.
So, and obviously we'll find out a bit more about your history later on. But question number one, fingers on the buzzers and they're conferring. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
Oh, gosh. You know, I have to admit the first person that comes to mind is Bob Dylan, but I don't know that that would be a very interesting. I don't think dinner is enough time to win him over to actually have a great conversation. I think you need a lot more time to become his friend. But I think Johnny Cash.
Oh, yes.
Would be the guy. I feel like Johnny is somebody. He's been a hero of mine and on so many levels. My wife and I just last night got to sing a couple of Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash songs at a tribute show here in Nashville.
Oh, wow.
I've been a fan since I was a kid, but both as an artist and a songwriter, but also as a person, there's just so much. He managed to thread a needle as a culture maker, somehow he got everybody to lean in and listen. When he said some really difficult things, he did it with such grace. And I just want to hear, I would want to hear more stories, some of the stuff that didn't make it to the albums. And I would want to get some advice from him, frankly. That's what I would want to do. I'd want to learn what it is that I could learn from a person like him that I can't get from the records. So yeah, that would be Johnny. And hopefully June would come along, you know.
Well, if Johnny can, I'm sure June would come along as well.
Right.
Oh, that's fantastic. Question number two. Who is your favorite biblical character or favorite biblical story or favorite person? Sorry, or favorite parable? I can't even read now.
Boy, I guess that's a really tough one. And whenever it comes to people asking me favorites, I just kind of don't overthink it because my favorite will change any given.
Yeah.
But right now, I guess I'm going to say Peter, and I'll wrap up passage and person into maybe just one example of why I love Peter. In one passage, I guess it's Matthew, maybe around 16, when in one sequence of events, Peter is called Satan. And then also Jesus says, upon this rock, his confession, I'm going to build my church. I just love that Peter is always saying the wrong thing. He never gets it. But he's the quickest and most eager to just rush in and at least say what most of us would be thinking, but are too cowardish to say or do. Peter does it. And so he therefore fails in the way, obviously, that we would fail privately. And then we get to see his failure and see Christ's reaction. Even when Christ calls him Satan, when he says, get behind me, Satan, he's really saying, line up behind me. Like, I'm in charge, like, follow me. He doesn't say, like, go to hell. He doesn't say, you're dead to me. He doesn't insult. He just says, no, you're trying to get in front of me. You know, because right then, that moment, the thing that gets Peter called Satan is that Peter says, wait, I got a better idea. We could do this and not end up going to Jerusalem where we're going to get killed. It's pretty reasonable. I think most of us would go, you know, I'd kind of like to not get killed. I'd like to maybe take an easier path in life. And Jesus, in that moment, he says, no, get behind me. Like, you're being my adversary. You're working against me. You're not working for me. And in that, you're being my adversary, which is what Satan is. You know, that just means adversary. So he's saying, he's not saying go to hell. He's saying, just get behind me. Like, follow me. Don't try to lead me. And I think, man, in that moment, I go, I just love Peter. And I wish I could hang out with Peter, because I see the transformation in his life and how he goes from being the first to fail, the obvious fail, the guy who doesn't get it, to later being the one who's able to sit and lead in a position of listening to everybody, building consensus, trying things, forming compromise. And I just really love that. And I think that in general, you mentioned people feeling disconnected from the church. I think that you talk about the church is often when people say that they're sensing a power structure and people that are not willing to compromise. They're not willing to listen. They're doing those Peter things from early in his journey without the part of realizing they're being Satan. They're getting ahead of Jesus. They're not following Jesus. They're not being loving. They're not willing to suffer. They're not willing. And they're not getting to that other part of Peter, which is that part that's willing to get behind Jesus, to follow Jesus and to listen and build consensus and be the rock, that confession that the church is built on. So I guess I'm going to say Peter.
Yeah, I got a feeling you might choose Peter. Yeah. Now, that's a brilliant answer. And I've got a feeling, we'll be coming back to that later on, especially what you were saying at the very end. Question three. Over here in the UK, we say if you were prime minister, but I'm going to adapt it. If you were president for the day and could change any law... Yeah, we do get news over here in Blighty as to what's going on over there. If you were president for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be?
Well, don't want to go down too much of a rabbit hole there, but I guess one idea I've had lately is I think all of the politicians should have to wear the logos of all of the people that give them money on their suits, the way race car drivers do, so that you know who they work for, because they clearly don't work for people. They don't work for the public. They work for the corporations and the interest groups that give them money. So maybe if they had to walk around and show that the way NASCAR drivers and stuff do, then when they talk, we would know who they actually work for. And that might shame them sometimes into saying things differently, at voting differently or acting differently, because it's just pathetic right now what's happening, and it's shameful, it's embarrassing. And I guess when these guys, especially the people who get up and they're using language of religion and spirituality, but then their actions and the people that they work for are working completely against that. So I guess maybe we could undo some of that if they had to just cop to who they actually worked for. So turn the lights on and watch the cockroaches scatter. Maybe that would have an effect. I don't know.
Great answer. Question four. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out?
Well, this involves my son. So, family was involved. A few years ago, I got to take my youngest son to Chicago, which is my hometown, to see a Cubs game, his first Cubs game, which is a baseball team.
Thank you.
It's kind of like your cricket, but...
but not as good.
But not... Okay, all right, fine. He'd been watching, he'd been into baseball, my son had been playing baseball, Little League, and the Cubs had won the World Series the year before, which was unimaginable in my lifetime. I never thought I'd see that. So Jesse had been caught up in that and gotten very excited about the Cubs. So they were actually a good team. There happened to be an opportunity for me to take him to Chicago to see the Cubs play and see U2 play the Joshua Tree album on same day. So we got to go back to Chicago, just the two of us, see the Cubs and U2 in the same day in Chicago on a beautiful day, walk around the city, took him up into a high rise to look at the city, eat Chicago food, walk around for miles in the city and see the parks and see the buildings and ride in a taxi cab and all that kind of stuff. And by the end of the day, after U2 was playing, he was full, and it was really, really fun. I had missed the chance to see the Joshua Tree tour the first time. It was in Chicago. I was 17 and I got sick. I was in the hospital. I had a ticket, but I couldn't use it. And, that was the beginning of the explosion of U2, my last chance to see them as a, you know, in that first iteration of their level before they blew up and became the biggest band in the world. So it was really sweet. And it was especially fun to see them with my son, who was at that time 14, you know, so it was really, really great.
But it makes you feel better. I had a ticket to go and see The Clash when I was living in Bristol and couldn't go because I was supposed to go to hospital that day. And I was there and the nurse came up because obviously the operation was the following day and I came in the night before, the night of the Clash plane at Colston Hall. And the Beacon, as it's called now. And she said, we could have gone to the gig. Oh, no, thank you. Oh, no.
Yeah.
But hey, I won't upset you by saying that I saw you two on the October tour to about 1,000 people. And then the war tour as well. But anyway, what has been your most embarrassing moment?
That one is so hard. My life is full of embarrassing moments. And I'm sure I'll probably have my next most embarrassing moment tomorrow, I'm sure. But I guess I have a certain willingness to kind of be a clown. And I think that I've turned that into some sort of superpower, and that's given me access to have moments that other people haven't been able to have because I just don't care. Probably it's when I finally get a chance to talk to somebody I've really wanted to talk to, and I kind of flub it, or I just turn into a fan. People think when you get to a certain level or you get access to a certain, you know, they have a perception of you as maybe that you're cool or something like that. And I know that I've invested a lot of energy into trying to make people think I'm cool. But I'm really just a fan like everybody else. Everybody is just a person, you know, that's the beauty of it. I mean, Bob Dylan might actually be cool, that he might actually have accomplished it, but he might be the only human who's ever actually done it. I think that everybody else, we're all just dorks. And there have been many times when I finally get a chance to talk to somebody and I just don't know what to say. Like, I can't remember what the question was. I can't, you know, I just get starstruck. But I tend to get starstruck around very unlikely people. You know, it would be, you know, a priest that did something really compelling, or you know, an author. It's not necessarily rock stars or celebrities or something like that. So my mind is awash in so many embarrassing moments. It's hard to know which one to pick out. But I think that it would have to fall under a category of thousands of times that I've finally gotten a chance to talk to somebody that I really admired. And then me, a word person, a talker, I just come up empty. And I feel like Chris Farley in that famous Saturday Night Live skit when he gets to interview Paul McCartney. Have you ever seen that one?
So Saturday Night Live.
Oh my gosh. You got to try to find this on YouTube or something. So Chris Farley basically is impersonating me. And he said he gets to interview Paul McCartney. He's basically like, oh, you remember that time you were in the Beatles? That was awesome. That's his question. He can't even function. And I've had a lot of those kinds of moments. I guess I'll think of one, which was when I was about 14 and I got to meet Mike Rowe of the 77s and one of my favorite rock bands. And I was 14. And it was the first time I got to actually meet him. And I was just kind of coming into this world of underground alternative Christian rock stuff. And they were the coolest of all of those bands by far. And they played with a band called Rez Band. And so they were standing at their merch table signing autographs. And I bought a black and white photo to have them all sign. And as I got to him, he was the last in line to sign it. And I finally got to, you know, hand it to him. And I said, I have a question. Is Mike Rowe your real name, or is that a rock name? And he's got shades on and he's looking, his hair is just he looked like, you know, Robert Smith from The Cure or one of the guys from The Alarm. And he looks down like, I don't understand. And I said, like Mike Rowe, like microwave or microphone. Is that a rock name, or is that your real name? And he just shook his head like, I have no idea what you're talking about, kid. And I just shrunk like, I here's my chance. This is my first rock and roll interview. I get to ask this guy something and I failed.
That's brilliant. You know?
Yeah. That's brilliant. And I felt like 1 inch tall.
Now, I've interviewed Mike Peters from The Alarm a couple of times. Really nice bloke. I'm sure he would have given you more time on that.
Mike Rowe has become a good friend and he swears he doesn't remember that. But
brilliant.
It definitely happened.
Brilliant. I do actually remember Glenn Kaiser. He came to play at our festival, at Crossroads Festival, many, many moons ago. And I was using one of his tracks off his fantastic solo rhythm and blues album that he did, the blues album. And I used it as a backing track for Enough, for what you'll be doing later on, the 2 Minute Hero. That was the backing track underneath. And I went up to say, "Pleased to meet you, Glenn. I use your music." And I was really excited. And he just looked at me quizzically as if, you know, he didn't know what I was on about. Bless him. But that wasn't his fault. That was me trying to be too enthusiastic.
Well, that same show that I'm talking about where I met Mike Rowe, I actually snuck backstage and invited Glenn Kaiser and Wendy Kaiser and the whole of Res Band to my house for dinner the next day.
Wow.
I'd gotten permission from my parents. I told them, I said, "Hey, if I can get a chance, can I invite this band over for dinner? Because they're on the road." And I've read about how, you know, bands on the road don't get much food. And my parents said, of course, our family was very hospitable. They said, "Yeah, we'll make chicken and pasta and whatever." So I had gotten permission, and we lived right down the street from where the show was, maybe a couple of miles away. And so I snuck backstage by acting like a roadie. I just picked up something that looked like it needed to be carried, and I just carried it backstage. And there's Glenn with all of his rock clothes on, looking triumphant.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just started stammering, and I talked a million miles a minute, and I eventually spit out this invitation for he and Wendy and the whole band and crew, everybody, to come over to our house the next day. And he listened, and then he said, "Oh, what?" He said, "What time?" I said, "Anytime that works for you. You know, anytime. We'll have all the food ready." And then Wendy walks out, and there's Wendy, and my heart's racing. And he says, "Hey, Wendy, this is, what's your name?" And I said, "My name's John." And he's like, "Oh, this is John. And he just invited us to come over for dinner tomorrow. Said he got this whole spread and you live right down the street." And Wendy goes, "Glenn, we're in Chicago. We live here. We got to go home." And he's like, "Oh, I forgot. We're in Chicago." I was like, for a few minutes, I thought I might pull it off. I might actually get the rock band of my dreams to come to my house, but he'd forgotten that they were back home and they needed to go see their kids and stuff. So anyway,
well, I'm really glad that you were able to answer that. And for those that are tuning in thinking, is this going to be a program about music? I've got a feeling it's the rest of the 45 minutes is going to be. But before we do, though, I just want to briefly talk about your book. And this is how I came to know about you. It's called Jesus Bread and Chocolate. And I was given a copy, an advanced reading copy of this about 7-8 years ago. And it was when I was going through a tough time with my wife, as in we were trying to do some things out to change the law on things, because my wife is registered blind and we're trying to change the disabled bills and stuff. And it really, really, really encouraged me. So thank you very much indeed for that.
Yeah, I really appreciate you saying that. That means a lot to me.
Well, no, thank you. I mean, and there's one or two lines. Actually, when I picked out the book, I realised that I've underlined so many pages here. So, you know, this has helped my research no end. And there's one thing here. You've got chocolatey versus chocolate. Purity matters, right? Mm-hmm. And you said, history is full of Christian-y people, Christian-y music, Christian-y nations and Christian-y churches. They claim the name of Christ but seem uninterested or unwilling to submit to his authority or take his instructions seriously. They borrow the symbols but miss the meaning. Maybe like the carob people, you know, that little berry thing that, you know, used to sell in the 70s thinking it was an alternative to chocolate. Maybe the carob people, they simply can't handle the idea that Christianity is rich, risky, which I've underlined here, sacrificial, dangerous, countercultural, hilarious, joyful, thrilling, lavish and celebratory. Christian preachers and teachers deify material blessings, place dangerous emphasis on the individual aspects of faith at the expense of the communal, and recklessly conflate the rhetoric and psychology of empire with the nature of the kingdom of God. That to me was incredibly powerful. That was what, maybe written about 10 years ago, something like that. What do you think now?
Yeah. I wish I could say things were better, but it seems so much worse. I mean, it seems like there's actually, I think when I wrote that, I had been on a 10 or 15 year path of recognizing that there were certain values of the Industrial Revolution that had formed and shaped the patterns and values of the church more than the church had shaped the values of industry and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that started the process of thinking through what led to that book. So that's why things like coffee and bread and chocolate and beer and music, they became just sort of the fruits that bore those stories out. So by finding people that were experts in those things, I could I could talk about underlying values, and they became really an excuse to riff on, which is what musicians do, you know, kind of jam on an idea. And so I talked to a friend who's a baker, or I talked to a friend who's a woodworker, I talked to people, and we got to the idea that a lot of these things missed the underlying point of what the craft or the art or the beauty of the thing was when it becomes so industrialized, so processed, so packaged, that it actually, the current version of it was really nothing like what the original thing was. You know, the bread that we eat now was nothing like the rich nutrient thing that bread was. Then we missed, and then there's some other values that we missed out as a result. There's values of community and culture and things that we missed. So when I, the more I dug into that, the more I felt like, okay, there's one of the things that I'm hungry for, or actually, most of the things that I'm hungry for when it comes to this are related to culture and community and integrity and authenticity and all these kinds of words. But we're just skimming the surface when we talk about those things. In order to dig down deeper, I kind of got to this level of what those things really mean. And then when I got down really to the nub of who I am and how my character and my personhood is being formed, I got to the nature of what the gospel is and what it wants to do to me and in me and how it wants to shape me. And I started to feel like, okay, the church as an institution is really not the tool that's going to accomplish that. The church as the body of Christ is. That's what that's designed to do. Kind of the way the immune system in the body is designed to work on injuries and wounds, to drive out infection and build health. The church as the body of Christ is designed to build muscle and strength, and not just to consume calories and process information, right? So all these things were happening. But now in the last 10 years, I've seen the ramifications of this, especially, well, I guess in both of our cultures, it's like this thing called evangelicalism, this thing called Christianity, whatever, has just borne out to where people are calling themselves Christians, but then embracing ideas and falsehoods and things that are completely antithetical. It's no longer even just passively antithetical. It's not saying I'm not actively embracing the things that are the gospel. It's saying I'm actively embracing things that are antichrist. Like it's gone so far that, yeah, we've got a whole generation or two or three of people that are kind of being forced out, and they're saying, you know, some of them are saying, I want nothing to do with any of it. Others are saying, well, I'm having to rethink where my boundary lines are falling. And so they're leaving institutions, but they're not necessarily leaving their faith behind. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of carnage. You know, there's others who are saying, no, I'm doubling down on this. Like, and if, I mean, we saw some stuff here in our culture where certain political people were saying, you know what, we need less sacrifice, we need less humility, we need less grace and love and more winning and kicking butt and taking names. And then we saw pastors and denominational peoples lining up behind them going, yep, that's what we need. And so we see them saying no to the gospel and no to grace and no to love and yes to winning and power and dominion. And it's just become abysmal and terrifying.
So what really, give us just one aspect that really gets your goat. Do you have that expression over there? That really gets your goat?
Yeah.
Oh, you do.
I do. Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. It's funny how GOAT has become an acronym over here for greatest of all time, GOAT.
Oh, like really?
Someone's called the GOAT. Yeah, if someone's the GOAT. And I just picked up on this in the last few months because people started referring to that as a good thing. Like, oh, she's the GOAT, you know, talking about Serena Williams. And I was like, what? GOAT was like a bad thing a while ago. No, GOAT is greatest of all time. You're saying, what gets my GOAT? What gets my GOAT is when people whose primary job, especially in spiritual leadership, so pastors, and frankly, in the last 50 years, what we now call influencers, you know, so authors, professional thinkers, we've abdicated our job as discerners, as individuals, to professionals, which is what we've done across the board in our lives. We say, you know, I don't know how to build anything, so I'm going to hire somebody to build it. I don't know how to cook anything, so I'm going to hire somebody to cook for me. We've been trained to think that our primary job is to be consumed. So most of us don't know how to do much except consume. So our pastors do our thinking theologically for us, and they even, unfortunately, have had to abdicate to celebrity pastors, to denominational leaders and stuff. So what really is driving me crazy is to see that these high-level celebrity-type pastors or influencers or gatekeepers are abdicating. They're either keeping their mouths shut because their jobs depend on it, their institutional success depends on it, and they can't speak up, they can't speak truth to power, they can't make comments about political idolatry, about, you know, things that are just not right, that are hateful, that are evil, that are antichrist, because too many of their constituents, I don't know if I want to even call them sheep, too many of the people under their care have not been discipled well enough. And if they were to start calling that stuff out, those people would stop tithing. And then the institution that they are a steward of would topple. They would lose their job. They would lose their buildings, that, you know, and the whole thing would topple. And so this hierarchical structure, this franchise, has become compromised. And good people in that system that really feel called to that are quitting. You know, it's kind of like you see good politicians who were called to serve, and they're just going, I can't affect change in this. I can't work in this system. So I'm out. And the people that are left, whether it's in the political sphere or the professional religious sphere, especially on the conservative side of things, are the ones often who are saying, nah, I guess I'll play this game. If this is the game, then I'll just play this game. And that's what drives me crazy is, and I think that, you know, the scriptures are pretty clear that those who are called to and accept the office of teaching are held to a higher standard. And when we've said, you know, that we're going to not teach that difficult stuff, we're not going to teach people how to think, we're going to just tell them what to think. And now we've got a generation of people that can't sniff out the difference between truth and falsehood, and they're just getting all of their information down one pipe, and they can't discern their way out of a wet paper bag.
Yeah.
And the people that do want to try to talk about discernment and thinking are forced out of the church because the church is so subjugated to this political corporate kind of mindset. And it drives me nuts because there's real people that are being hurt as a result of that. They're being driven to the exits.
Yes.
And I'm just committed to try to do whatever I can to be standing outside that door saying, ho, before you go too far, can we have a cup of coffee? Can we talk? What they're leaving might not actually be the church at that point. They're leaving might actually be something that they need to leave. But I want to try to stop them before they go off into the desert too far. You know.
Yes. Yes. I'm really glad you said that. I was just thinking whilst you were saying it about my own particular walk. Even before I became a Christian, I was a Sunday school teacher, which is, you know. But the people there, they were fantastic. And when I did eventually become, like C.S. Lewis said, you know, on his day when he became a Christian, you know, the most reluctant of all Christians, that was like me. No fireworks, nothing. You know, I remember phoning up one of the mothers from the church and say, I finally did become a Christian. And it was like, oh, that's good, dear. You know, I was expecting massive, you know, praise, money, everything, well done. But no, nothing like that at all. Right. But I'm saying this because there were people in my life who were prepared to listen to all my stupidity, all my questions, you know, and what I was getting up to. And they were just there with me. You know, it was fantastic. And it seems, I think what you're saying is that seems to be missing now.
Yeah, right. Well, it's happening outside of the church. It's happening outside of communities of faith. People are finding it online vicariously. They're finding it in, you know, chat rooms and on social media in tiny little bite-sized pieces that aren't sustainable. They're not the kind of things that are going to actually transform character and create real community, but it's like inoculating them. It's little bits. And they're also finding it in friend groups that are not connected to actual theological bedrock or anything that can, you know, provide answers or even resonance with hard questions. And so they're going to find it because that's part of human nature. We're going to find community. We're going to find people that are in the boat with us because we're designed to do that. I think that when I look at the scriptures, when I look at the disciples, when I look at how Jesus did things, he didn't find people and set up an institution. He set up a family. He set up an organism, and it was an organism designed to suffer alongside people who suffered and to provide hope and love and the fruit of the spirit, not an empire. And so I think that we probably are experiencing something that is not unique in the history of this. I think that it's probably good. It's just, it sucks, but it's good that this will winnow out. We're probably heading into a season where, again, the actual true body of Christ is the minority experience of following Christ, and that the empire, it's not going to be as obvious as Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon and, you know, 666 and all this kind of stuff. It's going to be something called Christianity and something called the church that people are going to have to discern the difference between that and the actual body of Christ.
Yeah.
And those who are serious enough to want to love their neighbor as themselves and love each other as Christ loved the church and that kind of thing are going to have to discern the way to do that outside of systems of power that work against that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I want to move on to your podcast yourself in a minute and explain more, and you can explain more about that. But just in closing the situation, what comes to mind also, and we've mentioned Glenn Kaiser, and for those people mm-hmm. saying, who's Glenn Kaiser? Well, you know, together with Phil Kagi, I would say I'll put those two up there as what, like one of the best guitarists, you know, America's ever given. Not just from a Christian viewpoint, from a secular point. If you don't know what I mean, check out Phil Kagi's Jesus the Revelator, but the Fender Strat mix, that is just... But going back to the 1960s, and hopefully you can see where I'm going from this, when we started to have the hippie era from 66, 67 onwards, there were a whole load of teenagers and people in their 20s trying to find out the meaning of life. And the church, most of them, said, we don't want you. You're long-haired. Get away from us. But there were a few people that said, actually, no, they're looking for something. We have the answer. And that's where you got Jay Pooza, wasn't it? Jesus People USA.
Jesus People USA, right.
Yeah, they came out of that. Can you see that happening again?
Yes, I do. But there's a little bit of a correction there. And I think that sometimes people have misunderstood the Jesus movement, which is what you're talking about, I think. The Jesus movement that got popularized but in the late 60s and in early 70s and probably is most known, and I was in that Jesus music film that just came out last year and is on Hulu and stuff here in the States. I'm not sure if it's available yet over in the UK, but lots is made of Expo 72 and 1972, this massive convention in Texas, you know, and it's worth knowing about that stuff. Maranatha music and Love Song and Phil Kagi and that stuff that I love. There's some great music and stuff. And yes, the Jesus movement that made it to the cover of Time magazine and Newsweek and millions of hippie kids becoming Christians and that stuff by that point is interesting. But you got to go back and look at the fact that in 1966 is when Vatican II happens. And all of a sudden Catholic churches around the world are allowed to have mass in whatever the language of the local people is. And folk masses are officially sanctioned. I've got records in my collection that are folk masses that go back to the 50s. There were people in the Catholic tradition, the Lutheran tradition, the Methodist tradition that were trying to use music and art and culture to connect with people in authentic ways, jazz music, folk music, all the way back in the 50s. It's not accurate. Sometimes evangelical people or people from that tradition have heard this story that nobody in the church was welcoming the long hairs and the counterculture. And that's actually not true. People in the evangelical world weren't, especially in the Southern American white evangelical world weren't. But in the Catholic and the mainland world, they were more connected to the countercultural values, anti-war, civil rights, environmental protection. There was an alignment of values between Christians and the counterculture. And there were some in America that were actually pro-Vietnam War and pro-military, and they didn't line up with the counterculture. And because some of the progeny of that strain has become dominant in the evangelical culture, the memory of that group is that Christian culture didn't accept the hippies and stuff. And if you grew up as a kid in the 60s in a Southern Baptist kind of culture, that would have been your reality for sure. But if you were a young person in the early 60s, late 50s, mid 60s, and you were feeling frustrated about racial injustice, you were feeling fearful about environmental degradation, you were feeling frustrated about the military-industrial complex, you might have been in a church that was Catholic or Presbyterian or Lutheran that had priests and nuns and leadership that was actually sharing your values and welcomed your your conversations and your questions. You might have seen your priests and nuns actually marching in the March for Peace in Washington, and you might have seen that the church was actually an agent for that kind of work, and you would have resonated with that. And frankly, I think that a big part of what led to that Jesus movement of the late 60s and early 70s was work done in the mainline church that plowed that soil. So then when this countercultural Jesus shows up in the late 60s, this long hair peace Jesus, you know, yeah, with the sandals and pointers, there's a whole generation of hippies that are listening to Grateful Dead and listening to Janis Joplin and listening to Jimi Hendrix. And all these artists are dabbling. They're talking about Jesus all the time. The counterculture loved Jesus as a guru. They loved Jesus and the message of Jesus as one of many great teachers and a pacifist, and, you know, but they just hadn't really gotten to him through the lens of the exclusivity when it comes to that. So I think that when we take a little bit of a wider look at that and we see Christian music or that version of gospel music, you even go back and see Sister Rosetta Tharpe in the 40s and 50s, this black African-American woman playing an electric guitar, helping to invent what becomes rock and roll, coming directly from the church. It just, it makes a lot more sense. But by the 70s, you see in America that the institution form around that music as more of an entertainment source for evangelical Christians, as opposed to an authentic cultural expression of an entire generation of people designed to talk to everybody. So that when the Rolling Stones are doing Jesus music, now that's not, that no longer seems to be happening, because now Christian music is designed for people that are living in this Christian world, and it's no longer talking to the whole culture. 1974, Sister Janet Mead has a top 10 pop hit with the Lord's Prayer, and that's the last time Jesus makes it to the top 10, because after that, you've got CCM as a subgenre, and so all the Christians can kind of go play by themselves over here. And that is interesting to me, because the Jesus movement was really when millions of hippies and young kids started to accept and find this countercultural expression of Jesus to be very, very compelling. But it very quickly got put into this box of a different kind of institution. It didn't seem like it, but it only took 5 years between, you know, Expo 72 and the Reagan years of kind of super conservative politicization of right-wing politics and this kind of expression of countercultural Christian stuff. So radical Christian. So you go, well, yes, I do think that it's possible that there can be a countercultural Jesus movement right now. But what'll happen is the institutional church will resist it, will persecute it, will hate it, will call it all kinds of bad names, you know, just like they did, you know, 50 years ago. But it'll still happen. And it'll be called satanic. It'll be called the devil's whatever. And it'll probably be driven a lot by music and speakers and things like that. And it'll offend some people. But then we got to watch, because in just a few years, and it maybe even won't take that long, because now with internet and technology and stuff, it can happen in a much more compressed amount of time. It too can become institutionalized. And so what we have to really think about is, I think anyway, is how can we form communities, and as individuals, how can we bind ourselves to communities where we can become participants in an organic expression that is not subject to the whims and the winds of culture so much, and we're not as objectified and abused by the trends, and just kind of that back to that original idea I had of we're primarily seeing ourselves as consumers. What if we're producers? What if our job is to primarily be producers of this stuff and not just consumers? And so our job is to say, well, who are the people on my street? Who are the people in my life that I can form community with and express the body of Christ with in a small way and actually be a blessing to this? And we start to look at the early church and we look at the ways that the body of Christ has actually won, not power, but love. And then replicate that.
Yeah.
And I think that would be that's when Jesus moves. Jesus, when we're looking for Time magazine covers and we're looking for big, huge things as indications of Jesus moving, we're looking at the wrong stuff. That's not the indicator that Jesus is moving. When Jesus moves, when hearts are changed, when people love each other unconditionally, when people meet each other's needs, you know, that's when we see Jesus moving. It's small. Now, it might happen small times 1,000, but that's not, Jesus never says, go therefore and, you know, and do huge, huge things. He's like, pick up your cross and follow me. Mm. You know, that's the Jesus movement. And I think that we need to disabuse ourselves of the math thinking, the kind of corporate thinking of branding and all that stuff, and say, what the Jesus movement is going to happen in my life when I start to disabuse myself of that corporate thinking and branding. And I start to think, where is Jesus moving right now today in my community? And how can I be working with that instead of, like Peter, working against it? And that is absolutely possible, but it's probably not going to make headlines. And if we're looking for headlines, we're looking at the wrong thing. We're Peter and we're saying, I got a better idea, Jesus, we could do this instead of going in the way that's going to lead to our persecution.
Yeah.
But then, you know, we're being Satan at that point.
Yeah.
But the good news is he can use Satan too. And maybe when he said, upon this rock, I'm building my church, it was a joke. Maybe he's like, look, I'm going to build my church on an idiot. and you're all going to be screwed up forever.
Yeah.
Maybe that was a big joke. I don't know.
Yeah. Listen, I'm looking at the time and we could talk for hours. So I'm going to bypass, if that's all right, your involvement with Capitol Records, because you were there for about 10 years, right at the top.
That'll be another time about all that.
Yeah, that'd be phenomenal. We're also going to bypass your time as a lecturer at a well-known university over in Nashville, isn't it?
Oh, Tribeca, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll bypass that as well. Sure. That'd be for another time.
Yeah, pull me in about 10 times to get the whole story.
Yeah, I think we'd have to. But I'd like to bring out in today, that's right, because you started up originally a little record store called True Tunes. Tell me about that, and then lead into, please, why you're doing your podcast on True Tunes, because it seems to be ever so popular.
Yeah, well, man, back in the 80s when I was just a kid, I just had this idea that, you know, there was this blowing up, kind of exploding Christian music world that was all about, it seemed to me anyway, about people who are already Christians talking to each other in Christian language, listening to Christian music, kind of creating Christian versions of whatever was popular in the world. That was not ever interesting to me. And the more they did that, the more the people in the rest of the world just kind of weren't allowed to explore those things. And to me, a lot of the most interesting music had, including classic rock and roll and folk and metal and everything, had been the stuff asking the hardest questions about life. And so once there was a Christian music ghetto, it seemed like as soon as an artist said, oh, you know what, I want to explore spiritual, you know, gospel ideas, boom, they got sent to this Christian ghetto. You know, that was where you belonged. If an artist had an experience in life and they said, you know what, I consider myself now to be a Christian, boom, they got sent over to this kind of Christian ghetto. They were no longer allowed to play in the regular world and talk to everybody. That hadn't been the case in the 50s and 60s and 70s. So I wanted to create a space where my friends and I could listen to and talk about all of the music that we found spiritually compelling. And that happened in the form of a record store and then a magazine and a concert venue that was called True Tunes that I opened when I was about 16, first as a part of a religious bookstore and then later as a separate thing. The magazine ended up going all over the world and we had a mail order company because back then that was what you did. You didn't have a streaming, so people all over the world would buy CDs and tapes from us. That kind of peaked in the mid 90s and another company bought it. And then their decisions led to it going out of business within a few years. They sold it to another company. I lost control of that version of True Tunes by the late 90s. I was out and I went to work for the Cornerstone Festival and was there for a number of years and then did books and all this kind of stuff. Well, a few years ago, the person who had bought it the second time had still been keeping truetunes.com. He'd been paying for that domain for years, but not using it. And he just offered to give it back to me if I had an idea of what I would do with it. And I'd been thinking, you know, one of the things that I missed most about True Tunes, I did not miss running a record store. I didn't miss having to sell stuff and worry about budgets and staffing and all that kind of stuff. But I did miss the community that formed around that place between the concerts we did and the fans coming into the store and the conversations. Music drew people together, a really wildly eclectic group of people, from black gospel fans to heavy metal fans to punk rock fans to skater kids in the neighborhood that weren't Christians at all to old people, this Orthodox priest that used to come in all the time and hassle me about stuff. It was just great. I miss that neighborhood feel that we had from being in downtown Wheaton outside of Chicago in this record store. I also thought, as a pastor for many years and a small group leader here in Nashville and then a house church leader, I thought, you know, music is one of the things we can gather and have conversations around, that is, it's kind of like a sandbox where people can, even if you disagree about all kinds of stuff politically or culturally or whatever, we can come around music and talk. And then there's the fact that after 30 years, I've kind of got a certain aptitude for conducting interviews and conversations, and I've just gotten pretty good at it. And yeah, I've been doing it forever, and I'm a writer, and I've got a lot of relationships. I've been in this scene forever. And so I know a ton of people, and I could just call them and say, hey, do you want to talk for this thing? And a friend of mine, Bruce Brown, who has also got a long history in radio and production, he had offered to help, because I only wanted to do it if we could do this thing at a really high level, and I just couldn't do it by myself. And Bruce offered to help. He's retired now. He worked for Voice of America in production for years, worked with CCM Magazine and stuff. So when he stepped in and kind of lit a fire under me and said, look, we need to do this. You know, none of these people are getting any younger, and you know, there's kind of a light under a bushel. And I didn't look at it as a business thing at all. I was doing all this other stuff. I just felt like this needs to happen, that there needs to be a place where people can come together across all different genres with no real agenda other than to demonstrate by doing it that conversation comes first. Conversation is a type of art form in itself. We're missing it these days. People don't get very many good examples of it. And the conversation can lead to understanding, and understanding can help us learn. But most podcasts I even hear are not about conversation as much as they are about promotion or arguing or some kind of an agenda.
Yes.
And music itself can also become sort of the wallpaper or the atmosphere of the conversation. So whether you know the artist we're talking about or not, we can use the music to create the atmosphere that pulls you into that space. And some people were saying, oh, so it's going to be about old school alternative Christian music. And we go, oh, but then we have a young gospel artist on, or we have a hip hop artist on, or we have Bruce Cockburn on, or we have, you know, so we're intentionally blurring all of the lines with the artist. And sometimes I've found some interviews from my archives with Rich Mullins or with Michael Bean from The Call. And we're really changing it up, trying to do it at a pretty high level. And the goal has been, we realized after we had done a few episodes that we came up with this idea of listen to better music and listen to music better. And that's because we think that ultimately that can help us actually become better people and better members of a community. That music, art in general, and in my case, music is the sweet spot, is actually an opportunity for us to practice being people. Like it's a playground. It's like when you see a kid in the sandbox working with a crane, you know, they're practicing skills that they'll use at some point. They might not ever work on a construction site, but they're still using muscles and they're using depth perception, and that play is actually part of development. And I think that even as young adults, as older adults, when we're listening to music critically and we're engaging and listening at a deeper level, it's actually doing something to us. It can trigger empathy. It can open up avenues of understanding. And that's stuff that a lot of Christians have never been trained how to do. And so sometimes we got to talk to people that aren't Christians, you know, got to talk to people that just, they've actually been engaging with music the way music is supposed to be engaged with, just as a message delivery vehicle or as a piece of propaganda. And then we can become re-enchanted with it. And I think that that's kind of the goal. And then frankly, I didn't even know for sure. I just knew that we were supposed to do it. And so we're doing it, and we're about 75 episodes in, and you know, we're still just getting started and people are just discovering it. And all of these episodes are kind of timeless. So you can listen today and then go down the rabbit hole and find out, you know, that you just go from episode to episode. And some folks today are going to hear an episode we did 3 years ago, and there's nothing about it that's dated, you know? So, and we hope that that this might help us regather some of that old school True Tunes tribe, as well as bring young people into it. And we want to see this group grow, because eventually we want to do some live events. We want to do some kind of, you know, small scale festivals. We like to travel around the country and around, you know, I'd like to go back to Ireland and, you know, do some events in around the world and gather artists and listeners together, whether it's 100 people at a time or 1,000 or 2,000, to listen together and build community in these pockets where we break down the barriers and what some people think of as barriers. I feel like sometimes we're like the dogs. I don't know if you have those invisible collars, you know, that you put on the dog, and if it gets to the edge of the yard, it shocks them a little bit and it trains them to stay in the yard. I don't know if you guys have those things, but
maybe eventually, I'm not a doggy person. So
well, here they've got these invisible fences, and you put this barrier on your yard, and the dog will get shocked if it goes up to the edge of the thing. And eventually the dog just won't go there. So you could take the collar off,
yeah,
and the dog won't go past the barrier because it's been so trained to be afraid of that barrier. And I feel like a lot of religious people have been trained that there are barriers there that are just in their imagination.
Yes.
And we're trying to kind of dissolve some of those barriers so that people on both sides of those imaginary lines can cross and realize that the only way we're ever going to be salt and light is when we're actually crossing those barriers, and that we on this side of the barrier need people from the other side to come over just as much as they need us to go over there and realize there is no barrier. And that might help us push against some of the corporate manufactured processed nonsense that we've become so hypnotized by.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in the remaining 2 minutes, before we go to your 2 minute hero, contemporary Christian music, what do you think of it currently?
For some people, I think it's lovely. I mean, if I certainly don't want to ever take anything away from a mom that wants to listen to something in the minivan to keep her from driving the van off a bridge. It's yeah, like, you know, so that's great. It's just very narrow. Like it used to be a lot more eclectic. It's become a niche unto itself. It's got its own style, and it's just not, it's not wide enough to have my interest. But there's within it, one of the things that is there is worship music, which has kind of become a dominant strain, and it's influenced quite a bit. There are aspects of that that I think are good, because I think that it kind of pulls it back towards the Jesus music of its roots. But there's also aspects of that that I think are very dangerous when it comes to churches using commercial music formula to determine what songs to use on Sunday. That's pretty terrible. But there's opportunities for churches to raise up songwriters in their communities to write songs for their own church, so that they're, because this music is not that hard to do. This kind of modern music is not difficult. And I've been able to, as a consultant, help churches raise up songwriters, train them, actually coach them. And I work with a couple of churches and ministries as a manager and a consultant. And sometimes a song can actually pop out and,
yeah,
you know, people around the world want to do it, but that's not the primary purpose. The primary purpose is to steward and train the people in that community so that they can actually be writing original music for their community.
Yes.
And so there's good to it. It's not as simple as just saying, oh, it's lame, it's terrible, it's bad, but there's so much room for improvement. But in the meantime, the streaming era that's happened now means that we don't really need genres like we used to, because people can listen to whatever they want to listen to. Mm. The indie side of what's happening in Christian music right now, the groups like Beach Chapel and Lovekin, I did a whole show on the Sacred Indie Underground, and it's a thriving independent scene right now, way more than we could have dreamed of 20, 30 years ago, because all you have to do is click on a playlist. So that is very exciting. Now, what I would love it is if some of these imaginary lines could disappear and artists from that scene could start to show up in some of the pop and mainstream playlists, because there's no reason for it to be subjugated like this or
yeah,
segregated. It really should be, some of these songs should be showing up. But see, Spotify and even those people, they've started to learn, oh, well, if we put it in this playlist and not this playlist, these people will listen to it. And they're learning from our prejudices that this music belongs in this lane and not this lane. And sometimes I think some artists who happen to be Christians need to think before they put themselves right in that Christian lane. And they need to say, well, you know what, I'm going to not do that, and I'm going to just duke it out in the mainstream, because I think that it's never been easier for excellent art to impact everybody. So before someone says, I'm going to do CCM, they need to be really thinking hard about who they are and what their mission is.
Yes. And of course, to sum it all up as well, you do not need a dry ice machine or blue flashing lights if you're going to do contemporary Christian music.
No, I don't think you need that if you're doing any kind of music. But if you have
you don't.
Have fun, I guess. You know, my son would use that stuff just to wake up in the morning. Tools are tools. You know, it's you're going to make a haunted house in your bedroom, and dry ice and flashing blue lights would be fun. But if you need that to make your music entertaining, then your music probably sucks.
Well said. Well said. John, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My hero is Mark Hurd, by the way.
Say again?
My hero is Mark Hurd.
Oh, Mark Hurd. Well, we'll come to that. No, I was going to leave. I was actually going to say, thank you for joining us today. All we have to do now.
There we go. It's done. You're done. There you go. Mark Hurd.
Is to hear more about you, about who your Christian hero is. This has been a BCSC production. Thank you for joining us. And if you want to get hold of us at all and ask any questions or want any more information, please write to us at ogc@accessradio.biz. Biz is spelled B-I-Z. All it leaves me for me now is to say, yeah, again, thank you, John, for joining us. Introduce yourself again and tell us who your Christian hero is. I've got a funny feeling I know it is. Over to you.
I'm John Thompson, and my hero would be Mark Hurd. He was such a fantastic songwriter and a thoughtful guy. Should have been right up there with James Taylor and all of the other great songwriters. He kind of found himself on the wrong bus that took him to a tiny neighborhood that he probably never belonged in, but he duked it out there for a long time. And I love his sense of pathos. And his songs just now, you know, all these years after his death, just continue to resonate. And as I grow and age, they just take on more and more meaning. And I miss him all the time. But I hope that my work is continuing the kind of empathy and truth and resonance that Mark was striving for when he was alive. So he's my hero today.
John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.